Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're doing something pretty specific. We're really digging into the precise, maybe sometimes even obsessive, rules of driving technique. We're looking at actual instructional stuff and setting that against, well, the chaos and the crazy violations you see every day out there.
Yeah, it's quite a contrast, isn't it? We've looked at sources that show, like, two completely different sides of driving. You've
Right.
got the super careful, test-focused teaching, the kind of precision you need to pass your test, especially in busy areas.
And the other side.
And then you have the data on all the dangerous, sometimes flat-out illegal stuff people do in heavy traffic zones. It's eye-opening.
So what we're doing is giving you a bit of a shortcut, really. This info is useful whether you're, say, prepping for a road test and need to know those little rules, or maybe you've been driving for years and want to shake off some bad habits, the ones that might get you a ticket, or worse.
Exactly. Comparing the textbook perfect world with, well, the real world.
Okay, let's start with the absolute basics, because that's where the precision really kicks in, right? The pre-drive setup. Seems simple, but it's where learners often slip up immediately.
Oh, definitely. Seatbelts, mirrors, everyone knows that. But there's one little thing in the routine. It's often forgotten, but instructors look for it.
Which is?
The e-brake, the emergency brake. Even on flat ground, it's a step they check. You release the e-brake, then you put it in drive.
Ah, okay. It's like a mental checklist thing.
Sort of, yeah.
Oh.
Shows you're engaged. And then leaving the curb, that sequence is like sacred text for instructors.
So walk us through that sequence.
Okay, it's signal left. Check your rearview mirror, check your left side mirror, and then critically do that mandatory shoulder check over your left shoulder.
That four-step process.
Non-negotiable. And forgetting that shoulder check, probably the single most common mistake before the car even moves.
Wow. Okay, so now we're rolling. Keeping aware is obviously key, but the guides mention a specific rhythm for checking mirrors, which sounds intense.
It sounds intense, but it's about building a habit. They say, check your mirrors every 5 to 8 seconds.
5 to 8 seconds.
Yeah, maybe closer to five if you're going slower,
Yeah.
maybe eight on a highway. Look, the exact number isn't the point. It's about constantly knowing what's around you, not just staring straight ahead.
Makes sense. And intersections. Even with the green light, there's that scanning technique. What's the pattern again?
It's always left, center, right, and then one final check back to the left.
Why the extra left check at the end?
Good question. It's because things change fast. And the car coming from your far left is usually moving fastest and gets there last. That final glance left accounts for their speed just before you enter.
Okay, that makes it practical, not just a drill. All
Exactly.
right, section two, stops and turns. This is where it gets really detailed. Let's talk about the two-stop rule at two-way stops. Most drivers I know stop once, then kind of roll. Why is that a bad idea?
It boils down to visibility versus just following the sign. The first stop, that's the legal requirement right at the line, checking for pedestrians. But often, your view is totally blocked. Parked cars, big hedges, fences, whatever.
Yeah, happens all the time.
So the second stop is where you carefully creep forward, just enough so you can actually see past the obstruction. Then you can properly check for oncoming traffic before pulling out. It prevents you from blindly rolling into someone's path.
So it's not just being overly cautious, it's actively managing a blind spot.
Precisely. It's a safe move, not just a rule.
Okay, that clicks. Now, right turns. The instructors insist on two shoulder checks for a right turn.
Yes, two distinct checks. The first one happens early as you signal and start slowing down. You're mainly looking for cyclists coming up fast behind you on the right.
Okay, that makes sense.
Then the second check is right before you actually make the turn, like literally just before you skid, making sure no pedestrian or cyclist snuck into your turning path at the last second.
Got it. And there's this interesting detail about the actual turn itself. Something about a quarter turn. How does that work?
Yeah, it's a neat technique for a tighter turn. As you're creeping forward, ready to turn, you turn the steering wheel about a quarter turn, like 90 degrees, before you fully commit to the turn.
Okay.
Why?
It angles the front of your car slightly into the turn. It kind of preloads the steering. This lets you sweep through the turn more tightly without swinging wide into the next lane or, bumping the curb.
Ah, so it keeps you compact. That's a pro move.
Definitely makes a difference.
Speaking of space, lane positioning on narrow streets, especially with parked cars, the advice seems counterintuitive.
Right. Your instinct is to hug the parked cars to stay away from oncoming traffic.
Yeah, exactly.
But that puts you right in what instructors call the door zone. The better way is actually to position yourself a bit more towards the center of the road, closer to the yellow line if there is one.
Okay, why is that safer? What are we avoiding?
Three main things. One, someone suddenly swinging a car door open right in front of you.
Ouch.
Two, pedestrians, kids, pets darting out from between parked cars. You can't see them. And three, cyclists who might be passing the parked cars. Staying more central gives you a buffer zone on your right, giving you more time to react.
That's a really good point.
Right.
Okay, shifting to left turns at traffic lights. Positioning while you wait seems key here.
Absolutely. First, signal early, maybe 3 to 5 car lengths before the intersection. Then, when the light's green, you move forward into the intersection to wait.
And where exactly do you wait? There's talk of a third line.
Yes, the third line. Think about the street you're turning onto. You've got the white stop line for traffic coming the other way, then the crosswalk lines. The third line is the one furthest into the intersection, the one closest to the center dividing line of that cross street.
Okay.
You want to position yourself so your shoulders, basically where you're sitting, are right over that third line.
Why there specifically?
It gives you the best view of oncoming traffic, but you're still clear of the crosswalk. And crucially, keep your steering wheel straight while you wait.
Ah, yes. Why straight wheels?
Simple physics. If someone rear-ends you while your wheels are turned, guess where you're going?
Straight into oncoming traffic.
Exactly. Wheels straight, you get pushed forward, hopefully avoiding a much worse collision. It's pure safety.
Good reminder. Okay, let's talk lines and lanes specifically where people seem to ignore them. Bike lanes are a big one.
Oh, huge. The rule is simple. If the white line separating your lane from the bike lane is solid, you cannot cross it. Full stop.
So you wait.
You wait until the line becomes broken. That indicates you're allowed to merge into that space to prepare for your turn.
And when you do merge for a right turn, where do you physically position the car?
You merge into the area marked by the broken line, essentially sharing it briefly, and then you turn to the left of the actual painted bike lane symbol or lines. You don't just cut across it from the main lane.
That merge is key. And it sounds like the same principle applies to designated turn lanes, people diving in late over solid white lines.
Happens constantly. That last-minute swerve is a violation. Plan ahead. Get into the turn lane when the line is still broken. Crossing that solid white is a ticket, and it just shows poor awareness.
Now, let's get into some of the specific bad behaviors our sources caught. The bus lane bandit.
Ah, yes. That's someone using the bus lane or HOV lane just to bypass traffic when they aren't actually planning to turn right soon or pass a stopped vehicle.
They treat it like their personal express lane.
Pretty much. It's illegal. You can get a hefty ticket and on a road test, often an automatic fail. Shows you don't respect lane designations.
What about turning right on a red light? It's legal in many places, but the advice seems to be maybe don't.
It is legal, usually,
Yeah.
unless a sign forbids it. But you absolutely must treat it like a two-way stop sign. Complete stop first, then creep forward to check traffic.
So why the hesitation from instructors?
Honestly, the time saved is tiny, and the risk is much higher. Misjudging the speed of oncoming cars, especially the ones far away, or not seeing a pedestrian. It's easy to get wrong. Waiting for the green is just simpler and safer most of the time.
Less stressful, too, probably.
Definitely.
And then there are the really blatant illegal moves. Our sources mentioned the Burnaby special. What's that?
The classic illegal U-turn right in the middle of an intersection. It's explicitly forbidden. It just screams impatience and creates a really dangerous situation.
Yeah, that sounds bad. And yielding to buses pulling out seems straightforward, but people ignore it.
They do. If a bus has its signal on and is starting to pull away from the curb, you legally have to let it merge, cutting off a bus. Another easy way to fail your road test, it's about respecting the flow and the rules for larger vehicles.
Okay, let's shift gears to situational awareness, predicting things, stopping distance behind other cars. There's a simple visual cue.
Yes, this is a fantastic tip. When you stop behind someone, make sure you can still see their back tires touching the pavement.
Tires touching the ground. Okay, why is that the measure?
If you can see their tires, it means you've left enough space. Enough space to maneuver around them if their car suddenly stalls or breaks down. And importantly, enough buffer so if you get rear-ended, you're less likely to be pushed into them.
Ah, defensive spacing, good one. And approaching crosswalks, a specific action.
Yes, a proactive one. As you approach any crosswalk, consciously hover your foot over the brake pedal for about 2 seconds.
Just hover.
Just hover. It primes you. Your reaction time, if someone does step out, is instantly shorter. It forces you to be alert right at that critical point.
Okay, here's one I found really specific. Knowing exactly where a school zone ends, how do you spot that?
It's tricky because you're actually looking across the road.
Yeah.
You see the sign telling you you're entering the zone, right?
Right.
To know where it ends, you need to look for the back of the school zone sign that faces the traffic coming the other way. As you pass the back of that sign on your left, that's the official endpoint. You can resume normal speed then.
Wow, okay. The back of the opposing sign. That's obscure but precise.
It is. Details matter for the test.
Quickly on traffic circles or roundabouts, the smooth approach.
Key is slow down early, aim for maybe 15, 20 miles per hour.
Mm.
As you get close, shoulder check to your right again, looking for cyclists. Then as you enter, scan left for cars already in the circle, yield to them, then check right as well while you're moving through.
And signals.
If you're going straight through, no signal needed. Signal right to exit, signal left if you're taking an exit past the halfway point.
Got it. Now, yielding failures were common in the violation data. Besides buses, where do people typically fail to yield?
The most common is probably pulling out from a side street or an alley onto a bigger road. Drivers just don't wait for a safe gap. They nudge out too aggressively.
Impatience again.
And a really important point instructors stress. Cyclists have to follow the same yielding rules as cars. Being on a bike doesn't give you automatic right of way if the situation requires you to yield.
That's a big one. But we also saw examples of pedestrians and cyclists not following rules like jaywalking or jay-scooting across an intersection, maybe even against a green turn arrow for cars.
Yeah, and that massively increases the complexity for the driver, especially on a test. Even if the pedestrian is wrong, the driver has to manage it safely and calmly. It really forces you into defensive driving mode.
Okay, final section. Dealing with the truly unexpected. This is where rules meet reality. What if traffic lights are completely dead, blacked out?
First thing, look for a police officer or traffic control person.
Right.
If they're there, their signals override everything. Follow their direction.
And if there's no one?
Then the intersection automatically becomes a four-way stop. Everyone treats it like there's a stop sign. Take turns carefully.
What about, say, a stop sign has been knocked over or twisted the wrong way?
That requires judgment. You have to read the road context. Even if the sign itself isn't visible or correct, is there a painted stop line on the road? If yes, you're still expected to stop at the line. You need to understand the intersection's intended design.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It may be the ultimate example of needing judgment over rules. A stalled car blocking an intersection.
Well, absolutely. Textbook says don't enter if you can't clear it. But if someone's broken down right in the middle, hazards flashing, you can't just gridlock everything. If it's safe, you might need to carefully maneuver around them, even if that means cautiously crossing a solid line at low speed. Safety and keeping traffic flowing, when possible, takes priority there.
That's real-world driving.
Mm-hmm.
And the big one for test takers. Getting stuck at a long freight train crossing during the test, what do you do?
Okay, deep breaths first. Put the car in park for safety. Don't turn the engine off unless the examiner specifically tells you to.
Does the waiting time affect the test?
The delay itself?
Yeah.
No. As long as you wait safely and don't make any errors while stopped. It will make the test longer, though. The examiner might have to cut some maneuvers later because of the lost time. But you won't fail just because of the train.
And when the train finally passes?
Don't just hit the gas. Do your full intersection scan again. Left, center, right, left before you proceed. Make sure nothing else is coming.
It's a really useful context. So wrapping up, we've definitely seen the two worlds today. The incredible precision needed for basic stuff, like that two-stop rule or the double shoulder check for turns.
Right, compared against the real-world chaos when people just ignore basic yielding or signals. It's quite the gap.
We pulled out some key takeaways, though. Remembering the tires touching pavement rule for stopping distance, that little quarter turn trick for tighter right turns, and how to spot the end of a school zone by looking at the back of the other sign.
Those specific techniques really do make you safer and smoother.
So here's something to think about. We drill all these very precise rules, mirror check sequences, lining up on that third line, staying away from parked car doors. But then the road throws curveballs, those dead lights, damaged signs, stalled trucks, long trains. How much does mastering those micro rules actually prepare you for the moments you have to use judgment, maybe even carefully break a minor rule like crossing a solid line, to handle a truly unexpected, chaotic situation safely? It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Is truly expert driving about perfect rule following, or is it more about knowing when and how to adapt safely when the rules don't quite fit the reality?